exclusively on CBS All Access. A Legend returns.
I have a mission. There's not a hell of a chance for somebody to stop me.
Patrick Stewart in Star Trek Picard. Now streaming only on CBS All Access.
Welcome to the Star Trek Picard podcast. I'm Dominic Patton, senior editor and chief TV critic for Deadline Hollywood. And we're now at episode 8 of Star Trek Picard, Broken Pieces, which dropped just earlier today on CBS All Access. Now, as I like to say every week, if you're looking for a recap here in our podcast, look somewhere else. There's going to be lots of spoilers. We're going to talk about what went down. But if you want to know what went down, I suggest you watch the episode and come back to us later. And you're going to want to come back to us later because, once again, we have showrunner Michael Chabon, who wrote all of today's episode, as well as joining us again, wonderfully so, is VFX supervisor Jason Zimmerman.
That's a hell of a report.
And you thought I was a desperate old man, quixotic, paranoid, possibly senile.
Let's just leave it at quixotic.
And now the windmills have turned out to be giants.
You want an apology?
I want a squadron.
Jean-Luc?
Clancy, out there in the Vide system, right now, beings who have as much right to life and liberty as you and I, or Commander Data, are being hunted down by an enemy who seeks to exterminate them.
Jean-Luc!
No, Clancy, if you say this is not a job for Starfleet, then I'm sorry, but you are a waste of space.
So today's episode of our podcast is talking about today's just recently dropped episode of Star Trek Picard, episode 8, Broken Pieces, which is written entirely by showrunner Michael Chabon. So, Michael, thank you for joining us once again.
I'm happy to be here.
Whenever this clearly is not the penultimate episode, but we're right on the cusp.
In a sense, it is, in that 9 and 10 are really one two-part episode.
Okay, well, thank you. You just stole that from me and took it a whole other place.
It'd be fair to say that it is the penultimate episode, in a sense.
And so what does that entail for you as a showrunner and as the writer of this episode?
I think the main thing was, you know, there's been this mystery that has been set in motion from the first episode about initially, like, who is Dodge and what is she doing and why was she killed? And then you find out, well, the Romulans are involved, and why are the Romulans involved, and what are they up to, and what was Bruce Maddox's role in it, and why, what does it have to do with the ban on synthetics and the attack on Mars? And
that was I want to stop right there, because that was a very well played out reveal. You know, we've had so much of the sense of that, because this is this poignant, pivotal thing that happened with the attack on Mars and how it kind of sets the stakes and sets the foundation for so much of the story. Now we're getting a sense of almost the intergalactic politics behind
it. Right. So what we knew was going in, and just even in thinking or planning for the end of the season, we knew we didn't want the end of the season to be the explanation of the mystery. But
that's interesting.
We wanted the end of the season to be the results of the discovery of the truth about the mystery. So the primary, this fundamental role of episode 108 is to explain and to finally discover the truth about what happened and why it happened and how it happened and what the role of Soji and her dead sister were in all of it, and have Soji learn that. And in making that discovery, you know, that is Soji's purpose. That's what she was created for. So it's a kind of fulfillment, a kind of culmination of her mission. And we sort of also then realized we kind of wanted to have, we had all these other emotional arcs in play. We had Rafis and Jurati's and Rios's, and those all felt like they should settle in a certain place of resolution so that when we go into the two-part final episode, if you will, the focus is going to be entirely on resolving the plot and in resolving ultimately the story of Picard for this season, and getting, and so that the focus can be entirely on Picard and Soji, their relationship, and what happens once you know what has been going on, and where does that lead everyone.
Now, it's a natural question to ask for a series that's been renewed. Is, are you going to be throwing out some seeds in this two-part finale for where we're going to be going in season two?
I think so. I think that'd be fair to say.
Is that – now, you know, different people, different showrunners, different producers, writers and directors have different ideas about that. Some people say, you know what, you should just kind of have your story and then the next season is another story. It's almost like a novel in a mm-hmm. sense. Like maybe you will tell me differently of all the people I could ask this mm-hmm. to, but very few people write a novel with the intent of I'm going to have a sequel mm-hmm. to my novel. Mm-hmm. I guess maybe you're George R. R. Martin, mm-hmm. you know, that's the sure. point. But that's a very select type. Why did you guys talk a little bit
well,
about that?
I mean, I think it really depends on the show and the kind of show and the kind of stories you're telling. I mean, if you look at a show like Fargo, for example, those seasons are completely, each one's in a bottle with regard to the others. You know, that makes sense for that show. Each season of that is seemingly designed to be a completely freestanding, multi-part story. You know, that's not the case with this show, and I think we felt really strongly, just as in a way, it's just a larger version of serialized storytelling. Like each, you know, with serialized storytelling, each episode builds on the one that came before, and you wouldn't want to watch an episode of, like, say, episode 7 of a serialized story and have nothing that happened before matter to what's happening in episode 7.
You know, some people do that conceit of the standalone episode.
Yes, I mean, to a degree, but you don't want to feel like it's completely unrelated in every way. That would be a little bizarre. So, you know, I think in this, we all felt pretty strongly, we all feel looking ahead to season 2, we don't want to feel like you watched all of season 1, you got attached to these characters, you got invested in what their relationships are or might be to each other, and then we're just sort of, you know, like shaking the Etch-a-Sketch and starting all over again, and none of that mattered.
I'm sorry, I'm already stuck on the Etch-a-Sketch reference.
Yeah, you remember those?
Nicely done. Age ourselves well there, my friend. Nicely done. Jason, there are a number of challenges, and we've talked about this before, about creating a show like Picard and the visual look of it. This episode, it has a very particular look and a very particular strand in which it tries to show the sense of this as an intergalactic being. I want to get an idea from you is, how did you develop the look you wanted here? Of course, we have the mini collective, we have the drones, we have this thing. How you and the DOP, did you work together and find the shaping of this?
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's, you know, like Michael's alluded to, it's definitely a collaborative process. So, I mean, you know, production design, director of photography, we all sit down, and when the script comes out, we talk about what does this want to be? What does this want to look like? You know, the director of photography is always so instrumental in setting the tone for things. And it's our job to then follow that, right? Because the best that we can do is to, you know, honor the lighting and the intent of the shot as it's, you know, supposed to play. And so I think, you know, yeah, we definitely sat down, had a lot of conversations about, you know, tonally, what is the lighting like in the cube, for instance? What does that look like? What does it look like when you're in close quarters, when you're in, you know, a large cavernous space? And so, you know, we definitely talked about that. And, you know, along the way, there was a lot of, you know, great, I think, concept work done by production design to sort of help us, inform us, and set us off on the right foot.
I mean, I think it also would be worth mentioning Doug Arniakoski, who's the producing director of the show, which
for sure
means that he is this ultimately sort of, just as the showrunner is responsible for watching and maintaining the tone of the writing across all the episodes. It seems to me, maybe I'm wrong about this, but it's the job of the producing director, at least the way Doug did it, to sort of keep his eye on the tone of the visual tone of the, and coordinate with the directors and the assistant directors and the effects and production design and all that to make sure. And he would be in there in every production meeting, Doug, bearing down and just getting the writers to say what we meant, what we intended, what should it look like, how many are there, is the light, what do you
think? Is that a difficult process sometimes? If you're like, yeah, you know, there's this thing and they attack and there's a lot of them. Yeah, and he's like, but what does that mean?
Well, Michael, the important part is that he's making that liaison. He's bringing it so that Jason can hear, so that the production designer can hear, so that, and then that they can ask questions like, wait, oh, I didn't quite get that. Like,
you know, so then let me ask, and if you can't remember, it's totally fair. What were some of the questions you asked for Broken Pieces when presented with the script and it's a, let's say, close to finished form? And
I can't remember that there are any in particular questions necessarily. I mean, you know, like he alludes to, Doug is very good at bringing up the question. A lot of I've worked with Doug for many years since before Trek Times. And
that's
he knows,
a very interesting term, Trek Time.
Yeah.
is that your autobiography?
Yes.
Trek Times. Yeah. And the road that well traveled.
And so he and I have a shorthand, I think, that works really well. And I think part of it is he can just read the expression on my face.
Yeah.
No, if you should go, hold on, guys, Jason's grimacing. We should ask him what that means. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But he knows, and he also knows visual effects and production really well, just in general. So having him on board for any episode is great, and he's there the whole time. So it's
should get him on the show.
Yeah, he's a great liaison.
Are you booking our show now?
I mean,
you come over here.
Somebody has to.
You're show running our show now. Oh my God. Yeah, you stick to your side of that fence there, Mister.
I'm just
if I ever win a big prize, I'll be like, and I like to not thank Michael for anything to do with this.
Hey, I just call him like I see. Him.
I see you do, my friend. I see you do. Okay, so then Jason, to that end. And again, not to put you on the spot, but I am going to put you on the spot. What was your biggest challenge for episode 8? And what was the thing that you're most proud of coming out of episode 8?
Man, I'm going to sound like a broken record. Borg cube again. The Borg bodies being jettisoned is some of my favorite shots of the season. It's one of our favorite vendors that we got to work with, and we really got to spend a lot of time just sort of dialing those in. And I think it's a really, really fun, exciting, cool sequence
for
visual effects, at least.
I agree with you. Yeah. I mean, it's great. But your perspective is so different than mine and many other viewers. It was like, what is it about that you're like, was it because I know you've talked about like there's the little details. It's not like just the big shot, but there's like the slightly askew thing in the background that you're like, that gives you a full palette. What was there here?
I think those shots in particular were actually very, very scopey. I mean, they were very, very big shots. They were shot against a blue screen almost entirely, you know, in one direction. So I think building that part of the cube, again, it's a cube interior, but seeing it from that perspective and then making, again, the challenge is always the size of something like that. You really, it's one of those things. I mean, if you've ever been to, you know, like Yosemite or something, it's not, you can look at a picture, but until you're standing below Half Dome, you don't realize how massive that is. And so I think
Mount Rushmore.
Yeah. Any of that big stuff, the mountains in Jordan when we shot there. I mean, there's something about being there and trying to translate that into a shot and into a show so that people look at it and go like, oh my God, look how big that is. And look at the scope and the scale. And so when you see the bodies coming out, you get a sense of like how many bodies that is. You know what I mean? That is building that scope and scale that helps tell that moment at that point in the story is really, really challenging, but also awesome when you see it on the big screen. So
your memories, your history, to you feel like incidents you heard about, something that happened to someone else.
Yes.
You feel that you don't have a past anymore.
Because I don't.
Oh, that's not true. You have a past. You have a story just waiting to be claimed.
You're talking about Data.
Among other things, yes.
All right. Tell me about Data. What was he like?
Well, Data was brave, curious, very gentle. He had a child's wisdom, unclouded by habit or bias. He made us all laugh. Except when he was trying to make us laugh.
Now, Michael, you know, part of what we learn in this episode is Jerry Ryan is back as 7 of 9. Like, incredibly back. Like, back and blazing. And we learn more about the killing of Bruce Maddox. In looking at the narrative arc that you guys have laid out, how much of that was where you wanted to be by now? And maybe I need to back up a little bit. In conversations that I've had with you and with Alex and Akeem and other people, everyone has talked about like, you know, we had this idea for the show and then this stuff happened. We're like, oh no, we're going to move this to 3 from 4. And now this person's available and we're going to put them here. And, you know, they're bringing Jonathan Franks back on screen and direct. Like there were, you guys were fluid. There was a little bit of jazz going on here, for lack of a better way of putting it, right?
Yep.
So in terms of that, knowing that and knowing that that's been part of the creative process and everyone's embraced it. And I think it's been a good embrace because I think it's worked. It's given this show a lifeblood that some shows you can kind of tell they're like, oh, that was definitely written before this happened. And why didn't they fix that? Because it doesn't seem to work anymore. How is this episode and those revelations? And we learn more about the Mars attack, et cetera, et cetera. How much of that is part of how you saw this and how it got there? Very long question. That's not even a question. I think it's like a Castro speech.
In its particulars, it changed a lot over the course of the writing and then into production. And like I said, like we didn't really, at some point I said, told you that we didn't really know that Peyton List was going to be playing such an active role in the story. So in particulars, in terms of like how you get from step 7 to step 8 in the particular episode, those kind of things change. But the idea of the why of it all, the underlying politics, as you called it, the underlying the history that played into the way that people, the way the Federation responded, the way that it did, the way the Romulans were doing, the reason the Romulans were doing what they did. We made adjustments over the course of this season. We got deeper understanding sometimes, and things would emerge from something that would appear in script 4 or 5 that, you know, all you start with is an outline, and the outline is stuff happening. And it might even say things like, you know, even if you're planning for an emotional scene between two characters, it'll just say, you know, Picard confesses his doubts to Riker, something like that, let's say. Well, what does that mean? When you're writing that scene and Picard and Riker are talking to each other, you might, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning when I'm writing, something emerges from Picard's mouth, or Riker says something back to Picard that you couldn't have known was going to be part of your story until you got to it, until that moment happened. And there you have this, if you're doing it properly, you're vividly imagining two real people having a real conversation. That can't happen in an outline. That can't happen in the room. It can only happen on the page. And certain things would emerge on the page, and things characters said or did to each other or for each other that then had a bigger ripple effect on the overall plot that we would have to go back and tinker or maybe change a line in ADR in an earlier episode because something that seemed like it was important is no longer important, or vice versa. But overall, in terms of what was supposed to happen in this episode, it's essentially the things that we always imagined would be happening.
Did you view this, because you've talked about the episodes 9 and 10 being kind of two-part finale, do you view episode 8 as a – do you view Broken Pieces as a transitional episode? Or how?
No, not at all. I think I see it as a kind of culminating episode, not in the sense of like culminations that seems to imply the last, but it's an episode – ideally, where all the threads are gathered, right? Where all the broken pieces are put on the table.
Saw what you did there.
And you begin to put them together, glue them. You know, they're ready. You have them all. You know, the cup got dropped on the floor. It broke. You go down on your hands and knees and you start picking up the pieces and you lay them on the table and ask yourself, can we actually glue these back together somehow? So I think, you know, it, in that sense, maybe transitional is a fair description, but it actually felt like more like we finally got to the top of the hill and now we jump on the sled to go for the downhill.
So going into that, going into 9 and 10, mm-hmm. how is this going to work? And again, I don't want you to give me any spoilers. Well, when we get to those weeks, we'll talk about those episodes. But if you're setting it up like that, two-part finales, very kind of in some sense, a very traditional television approach, but also very untraditional when you look at it, how you, there's so much resolution that's happened here with 8 and Revelation.
Revelation, yeah.
So how will that work going into those last two episodes? How will that sled go down the hill?
Really fast, I hope, and fun.
You're not going to let go of the mission.
You brought it back up.
You brought it up.
But we could have just let it die, but you had to, you know.
Who would ever want to let a good metaphor die? I mean, really, you put it in your back pocket forever somehow, Rosebud, right? One way or another, it comes up again. An aspect of this episode, which again, I'll mention that Michael wrote solo, is you have a real sense of the full bench of your cast here. Clearly, the show's called Picard, and clearly a lot of people showed up because they want to see Sir Patrick play Jean-Luc again. Right. And over this, you've been embedding and weaving in new characters, old characters, return characters, cameos, innuendos, et cetera, et cetera. But I felt like, especially Michelle Hurd, I felt in this episode, and I think Michelle Hurd's been great over the entire season, but I really felt in this episode, you sort of saw Raffi as more knowing than you expected.
Yes.
She's like, see? Not crazy lady in the desert.
Right.
It's like, there is something going on here.
Right, right. I mean, yeah, that, I think it's a 10-episode arc. And you know, especially it can be tricky, especially when you're used to watching Star Trek that is episodic, with the exceptions of the episodes of Deep Space Nine that were multi-part epics, which was really radical at that time. I mean, obviously Discovery has been serialized, but still, I think deep down inside we have this habit, if you love Star Trek, this ingrained habit of expecting what's wrong with the character, if there's something wrong with the character at the beginning of the episode, to be fixed by the end of the episode. And that can't happen, and it shouldn't happen in serialized storytelling. So with Rafi, we always planned to redeem her. Like, we always planned to get Rafi that when you see Rafi first, she's at her lowest. And the point of this whole season from the point of view of Rafi's character is to get Rafi back up on her two feet and functioning again in the way that she's capable of functioning. I think in some ways it's almost like a tribute to what a good actor Michelle Hurd is, that she's sort of fools you so well into thinking that Rafi's a total basket case early on, that it almost comes as a kind of a little bit of a surprise to see her fully restored to her true Rafi self. Although you got a taste of it in that flashback to episode three, at the top of episode three, where you see the prime Rafi at her peak, having not yet encountered defeat and disappointment.
Now, flashbacks are a necessary part of telling a story like this, unless you just want to do the voiceover part of it, or just like quick conversation and hope you fill in the blanks.
Dialogue, yeah.
But you can describe it as that. Was that part of, as you've talked about, there were times when you were working on scripture, like, oh, we need to put this here because that's going to happen here. Was that instance with her and Jean-Luc outside Federation headquarters, for lack of a better expression, was that one of those where you're like, we need to show prime Rafi, well, so when the resurrection occurs, people are like, I knew that woman. She's back.
Yes. I mean, we had so much time to cover between the last time we saw Jean-Luc Picard and when we see him again, what happened to him in the interval? What's he been up to? What's he been doing? Then we introduce all these other characters who the audience has never even seen before. Not only what have they been doing in the interval, but who are they? Where did they come from?
And then interconnecting them with the larger TNG story and the canon of stuff.
Right. How do they fit into the whole big picture and all of that stuff? And so, it seemed flashbacks are a great tool for that. And we try to really avail ourselves of them. But in choosing, you still have to pick. Like, we can't do 47 flashbacks. We have to really only do one flashback about Rafi and Picard and their relationship. So what moment should we choose? Let's try to choose a moment that has the most plot oomph to it, that will help us fill in the viewer on what happened in the past. But also, how could we frame that moment, or how could we choose the actual scene in which that takes place, in which that information is conveyed, in a way that will also help, hopefully, convey the nature of the relationship between Jean-Luc Picard and Rafi? Because we want to say, we're inventing this character that has a long-standing relationship with Jean-Luc Picard, but if we just dropped her in, you don't even know what that really means. So, yeah, we tried to choose the moments as flashbacks that were not just valuable from a plot point of view or filling in the holes in the story point of view, but also would give us a chance to sell the narrative of the character herself and what we're trying to show about her or about Picard or whoever it might be.
In terms of selling that narrative, Jason, I mean, one of the things in this episode is we really see Jerry Ryan's hero moment here. From your point of view, in visual effects, how do you find that balance between really like, okay, I'm going to blow their minds visually, but I also am going to let this really good actor have her time and really let her shine as well as an actor?
Sure. I mean, I think, first and foremost, it's about the story. It's not about the spectacle that we can create, right?
That's so rare to hear a VFX person actually say that. I don't mean that in disrespect to the industry. I mean, just like, that's your job. So when someone says, actually,
it is,
we want another job.
And it's always like a balance. Like, there are times where you have an idea and you're like, what we could do here. And it's something that would be so over the top, it's not going to really serve the story. I think in that particular case, especially with acting,
which means Michael said yes. He's like, yeah, we should do that. Totally.
But I mean, it's a performance-based moment, right? Most of that is performance-based. It's character-based. So for us, it's, you know, we have to help inform the story by placing the holograms in there for her to, you know, interact with, and the tubes that come down and sort of link to her. But other than that, it really is about the performance. So for us, it's about being subtle and just making sure that we're in step with the, you know, what it's supposed to be tonally from Michael's perspective.
You know, you guys, you did a really impressive job with Jerry. I mean, I actually think you've done a very impressive job with all the legacy characters, but that's hard to do. A lot of times on shows, when there's a revival or something, bringing back older characters, there's sometimes a cringe-inducing part of it. It's like, did they just clearly brought them back? Because, like, it was a payday. It was a nice thing. They threw them in. This was something – I thought she was gone. And now she's back, and she really was back now. What is that like? And what was that like working with her in terms of that? Because, I mean, that woman is on, like, she is a full-on, as a human being. So to bring this character.
See, I mean, I always loved the character of Seven of Nine on Voyager. I understood when I was watching Voyager in first run that, in addition to her, you know, incredible physical beauty, what I was responding to in the character of Seven was the performance itself. Like, what, you know, maybe having grown up watching Leonard Nimoy play Mr. Spock and Brent Spiner play Data, you know, I had the understanding that to play a character whose emotions are limited or restrained, or who, in the case of Seven, who has a problematic relationship to her humanity, that what might seem expressionless, quote unquote, is actually an actor working really hard to convey the illusion of expressionlessness through being expressive. So, you know, I understood there was a good performance going on there, but I didn't realize until I saw her on the show and we brought the character back and we proposed to Jerry Ryan that now you are older, you have lived longer, you have been through more experiences. Voyager was a long time ago. And watching what she did with that and the nuance of her performance, the tiny details, very similar to Patrick in a lot of ways that I've always noticed about Patrick, that, you know, he can act with like one muscle in his face. You know, he moves like one part of his cheek and a whole emotional vector of the scene changes. And Jerry has that ability to just, she's such a gifted actor. And I don't think I quite understood that until I watched what she could do in this part. So by the time we have her come back in this episode, I mean, we just knew she could do anything. And she's a complete professional too. I mean, she just stepped onto the set every day and seemed to know exactly how she wanted to do things. And it always worked beautifully. She's really fun to be around. She's a fun person. It was a thrill to have her to work with. And, you know, we're having her back.
She's coming back. We're going to wrap things up for today. We're moving clearly towards this two-part finale. And I always say this, no spoilers. But I do want to ask both of you, and clearly you're going to come at it from different places. I'll start with you, Jason. How satisfied are you with how this season went and how it ends?
Very satisfied. I think...
Scale of 1 to 10.
Probably 10. I think.
Nice.
For the work that we've done and the team that I have is incredible. I think... this is the best we've put out thus far, the work that we've done and the work that the vendors have done and the artists around the world. Like, I'm really proud with the quality of the work. Not that I'm not the other things, but there's something just very satisfying. I mean, obviously contributing to the story is a huge part for us. But we were given the time that we needed, the tools that we needed. And I really think it shows up on screen and we're real proud of it for sure.
Mr. Shavon?
Well, I will also give Jason and his team complete 10 for what they've done. From my point of view,
gold medal.
I'm 100% satisfied with the level of our commitment to making the show the best that we could make it. You know, I've never had the experience in my life as a writer of feeling satisfied with what I've actually done.
Never?
In terms of, no. I mean, the thing that you envision when you first begin to envision the story, whatever that's going to be, is perfect. And from the moment you move from that envisioning to actually making, all you're doing is fucking it up. So When I'm finished with a novel or short story or whatever it might be, I don't actually want to ever look at it again or see it again, because I feel like all I'll see is all the ways in which it didn't measure up to what that initial shining mirage of perfection was when I first anticipated doing it. So it's, you know, it's, that's just an inevitable part of my process. But in terms of how much we talked to each other and how much we planned and how much we thought about it and how hard we worked and how flexible we turned out to be when new opportunities arose and when it, you know, became possible to have Marina Sirtis, for example, but only within this 4-day period because she was doing a show in London and we couldn't get her before and we couldn't get her after. So that meant we had to move this part of that block into that block. And, you know, in terms of our being able to sort of rise to the occasion and roll with things, you know, and to try and to do all that in the service of creating a Star Trek show that is Star Trek and tells a good story and gives these incredible performers opportunity to do things that I don't think either they or knew or we knew they were going to be able to do in the course of the season. For example, with Santiago Cabrera and his performance as the multiple holograms, which you see in this episode, like all of that stuff that I'm satisfied with in terms of the what we brought to it, I'm satisfied with. What we ended up with, I think you can always do better. Always. If you don't think you could do better, then I guess you retire.
Can I change my 10 to a 9?
Not now, buddy. But I will tell you this. You know, I get a lot of emails from people from the podcast. And one of the things, you know, and there are various types. And most of them are criticizing me, rightly so. But one of the things that people talk about again and again is they kind of dreaded this. When Patrick stepped on stage in Vegas, they're like, oh, it's not going to be. And perhaps this is the sort of people who just take the time to email. But they almost universally say, I fucking love this show. You know, I love what they've done, and I love how they didn't just recycle Jean-Luc back onto the Enterprise, et cetera, but they showed me a man, and they showed me a story as well as a legend. And I think, you know, I'm a TV critic. This is what I do for a job. Michael, that's pretty high praise.
It is, and I'm really, that makes me happy to hear. I mean, on the other hand, we had no choice, in a sense. Like, Patrick Stewart is 80, 79 years old. You know, he's a different, just as we all are. You're a different person 20 years later, however old you might be than you were 20 years ago. So there were these essential facts, physical facts, what you see in his face, Patrick's face, I mean, what you see in his eyes. And then if you take that and you think, well, what has happened to Jean-Luc Picard? What's happened to Riker? What's happened to Troy? Where are they in their lives? It could never be the same. If it were, it would be a lie, right? It wouldn't be true to life at all. So, you know, it was a given that we had to work with. And I think the important thing was, I think, is that we embraced it. You know, we just embraced the thing that was forced on us. Just by life, by circumstance, by time, we incorporated from the beginning, was built into the kind of story that we were telling, which therefore could never be a story like we've ever seen before on Star Trek, because Star Trek's never done that before. It's never had the chance to do that. I mean, maybe bringing Kirk back in Generations, you know, they were sort of grappling with some of those same issues. I don't think the embrace was quite as full in that sense, as what we have done here. But yeah, you know, we try to make the most of what we had, and what we had was so incredibly powerful and rich and timely, and you know, and we had this amazing performer, one of the greatest actors of our time, who could do anything.
You can't really end better than that. That's a perfect ending.
All right,
you get 10 out of 10 for
it. Thank you.
Well, that's the end of talking about Episode 8, Broken Pieces, on today's podcast. Thanks for listening to the Star Trek Picard podcast, and get ready as we go into the next 2 weeks for the two-part finale. But until then, as you know, and when we get to those finales, you can always listen to the podcast every week on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you like getting your podcasts. Until then, see you next time.